where sports and politics smash. Thursdays at 10 a.m. and on iTunes and Google Play. WPFW, Washington, D.C.
Welcome to On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is Priya Fulci. Priya Fulci is the author of Good Friends, Bonds That Change Us and the World. She's also the co-author of Tell Me Who You Are. Priya Fulci is presently pursuing an African-American study PhD at Harvard University. How are you doing this morning?
I'm great. How are you?
Okay, well, as I was saying before we went on the air, I love your book. I just want to say that. It's a book that I think, as we discussed this morning, I think people will probably say, oh, I've got to read that. And I want to begin with a basic question. Why did you write this book, and what was happening in your life when you started working on it?
Yes, so I think maybe I could go back to high school with the origins of this book. So I organized for racial literacy to become a graduation requirement in my school district with my good friend Winona Guo, and we were 15 years old.
Where was the school district, its location?
Princeton Public Schools. And so we were 15, we created a racial literacy nonprofit, we wrote racial literacy textbooks, piloted them in fifth grade classrooms, printed them, educators and all across the country started showing interest, and largely students too. It was a grassroots effort to kind of get curricula in K-12 schools. We deferred college, fundraised, traveled to all 50 states, wrote another book called Tell Me Who You Are, our last book, another racial literacy book, and then started college. And so for me, friendship was always a very central kind of role in my life. It just made sense. I always say the smartest thing I've ever done is ask for help. So with the organizing work that I've been a part of, friends, local people, community is just enabled everything. However, I very quickly, kind of when that friendship entered the public space, when we were doing interviews or going to speak at schools, started feeling really weird and odd for having a friend. One of my college professors told me, stop starting all your sentences with Winona and I, you know, launch your own career, you know, build your own name up and all of these things. And so that's when, as part of my undergraduate research, I was curious about why friendship is so systematically dismembered, why it's so hard to hold on to a friend as you grow older.
Hmm. And you do something which I think is key to the book. You construct your book around the teachings of Aristotle. So talk about the three types of friendship that he defines.
Yes. So Aristotle in Nicomachean Ethics has, as you say, proposes three kinds of friendship: friendships of utility, friendships of pleasure, and friendships of virtue. Friendships of utility can be kind of when we think of friendship as networking. Friendship of pleasure is maybe most common, especially for my generation, Gen Z. It's people you party with, people you watch Netflix with. They're relationships that kind of feed your self-interest that don't necessarily challenge it, and that are circumstantial. So there's this great New Yorker comment that I saw where two friends are hugging on the street outside, and one is like, okay, it was so great seeing you. The next time you're in the city, on my block, on my street, in front of my house, we should totally hang out again, right? So these relationships are frail. They're not very muscular. And then his third category of friendship, friendships of virtue, are when your self-interest kind of grows to encompass somebody else. It's a more profound, reciprocal relationship. Aristotle has his problems, which is why the book departs from Aristotle to the thinking of Black feminists like June Jordan. But that's where I kind of start off.
Well, go back to Aristotle. Were there things when you were reading? Well, first, what led you to Aristotle? Were you reading something in terms of philosophy, and then you just came across this? You were searching for his definition of friendship, or how did that happen?
That was largely because of my advisor and mentor, Eddie Glaude at Princeton, who was advising the undergraduate research. He was like, you know, we don't have to reinvent the wheel. There's a lot of Western philosophy that actually seeps into the way all of us do friendship today. But where the most important kind of part of the research for me was when Professor Glaude said, you know, be in conversation with him. Like, we don't need to stay with, because Aristotle excluded entire categories of people from the relationship of friendship. He didn't believe women could be friends. It was this kind of elite superior relationship. So it was important for me, although I started there, to kind of push out from there as well.
Were there any women thinkers that, for example, that you could say, okay, I've got the Aristotle model, but this model, you know, might be Susan Sontag, it might be Adrienne Rich, somebody that, yes, you know, that's a woman that says, okay, this is how I view friendship, that you could have relied on also.
June Jordan. Okay. I mean, June Jordan was the person who I eventually just took over completely. And it's because, first of all, she writes about friendship in a way that she fashions it so that, you know, all of us are invited into the relationship. And also importantly, she, you know, the third category of friendship, the most ideal category of Aristotle's, I said, friendship of virtue, some translations actually translate it into perfect friendships. So he saw them as like two perfect people kind of coming together and uniting, right? But I mean, I'm a very imperfect friend. I think friendship is improvisational. We don't have any templates. Nobody teaches us how to be a good friend, right? And so messing up is almost guaranteed. There's an Irish poet who says, friendship requires continuous mutual forgiveness, right? Mm-hmm. And June Jordan writes about friendship in a way that's messy and that where mistakes are made. And to me, that's still a revolutionary proposition, because it still says that friendship is center stage, you know, not merely accessorizing romantic and familial bonds, but that it's good, bad, everything in between. It's as complex as any other relationship.
You know, when I you looked at June Jordan, there were two other writers that I thought of when I think of, of what they meant to communities and who I saw having many friends. One is Toni Cade Benbara, and the other is Audre Lorde. And I just was wondering in terms of them, you know, and I find it interesting because they all are linked to City College when June's there. They're all like, you know, so they were all like Audre Lorde, Adrienne, they're all at City College, you know, and there was a friendship that was there. And I always felt that when I looked at that photograph of the sisterhood, Toni Cade Benbara seemed like a person that would be missing from that group.
Yeah. And you're right. Like when I was researching, especially how June Jordan and Adrienne Rich came into contact with City College, and like just to be a fly on the wall in that space during that time.
Right.
All the people who were teaching there at the same time. But Toni Cade Benbara for sure. And I do have to look more into, I really do want to look into her archives and kind of pull that in more. Audre Lorde, I do write about her letters with Pat Parker. In the long distance friendship chapter, there's an incredible archive that captures a long distance friendship between these two women who were battling cancer, you know, as well as trying to maintain and grow their friendship and love each other through that.
Well, let's go back. There's something that you have in the second chapter, the individual, where you're talking about June Jordan and you're comparing her to Henry Davis Thoreau.
Yes. So, you know, I'm Gen Z, and Gen Z is crowned the loneliest, you know, generation. And a part of my effort to write this, I talked about my friend Winona, and, you know, some professors were like, have you seen the movie The Social Network? You know, be careful. Keeping friends close, is they're going to stab you in the back. And so we have this kind of individualistic great man solo icon model for, you know, any life. And Henry David Thoreau is, especially as I was growing up, kind of the person who was self-reliant and lived on his own in Walden Pond and wrote and read a lot, right? And this similar narratives about like Steve Jobs, like all these people. But in reality, Henry David Thoreau was writing in Walden Pond in his friend Emerson's cabin. His mom came to do his laundry, right? And so friendship is dismembered in collective memories, in archives. There's this whole like revisionist history that's going on. And even if, you know, these like great figures didn't have a friend in the way Thoreau actually did, like framing them as individualistic people invisibilizes the systemic kind of friendship and help that they do get through life, right? Through their relationships to power and privilege. So June Jordan tries to go into the wilderness and mimic this lifestyle of Thoreau, living alone, and she's sexually assaulted. She realizes very quickly, like, this is, she has this beautiful line, like, I want to go back into a crowded city, like, I want to have noise and neighbors, and this quote, which blew me away, which is, what does it mean to be a legend to all and a friend to none?
Yeah, you know, I didn't know all this about the Thoreau thing, but I do recall being out in Long Island with June in the winter months, you know, with a stick because of the dogs, because nobody's out there.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And yeah. And for me, from the, that's a long way from the South Bronx, okay? You know what I'm saying? Yeah. But what happens is that, you know, I didn't realize how much that was a part of that need to have a space for yourself, that the individual needs that space.
Yeah.
And I look at the fact that many times in the literary community, there were people who just didn't know June. I mean, she pretty much kept to herself, you know, but at the same time, you see that when she's out in California, all these students, you know, like she's like the center for that. So I was wondering about this, and this gets into migration and how people move around. Is a June Jordan from the East Coast is different from the one on the West Coast?
Huh. I'm sure, because we're all in relation to the people we are around, right? Like, of course, there must be like some kind of core. You knew her. I did not. Mm-hmm. So there must be some core qualities about a person. But at least in my experience, the way I am, I lived in the Bay Area because I was, you know, trying to meet some of June Jordan's friends and interview, and you know, and then I was flying back here to Harvard to the Schlesinger archive to go through her letters and things. So, and even in that kind of movement coast to coast, and the people who are in my kind of networks on in either place, I become a different person in their company, you know.
Mm-hmm. Let's have you read an excerpt. This is page 9, because it takes us back to Aristotle, and I just thought that this passage was very interesting in terms of this page 9 and 10.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Aristotle says friendship of virtue is the highest form of love. Today, marriage is the highest form of love. Companionship is romanticized as the purpose of marriage, not friendship. Friends exist only if fun or useful. There are no airport chasing goodbye movie scenes for friends. There are barely any songs or literature. With romantic partners, people make vows like in sickness or in health, but commitments to friends look like BFF bracelets. Romantic partners are considered soulmates, not friends. Finding romantic partnership is presented as the fundamental quest for meaning and fulfillment, not friendship. When I was in my first romantic relationship, somebody asked me how my better half was doing, and I rambled about Winona until I was interrupted. He had met my romantic partner, not her. But what if Winona was my better half in part because she was not my girlfriend? Because at their best, all relationships resemble friendships of virtue, whether with your lover, parents, or siblings, a relationship inclusive of pleasure and utility, but not limited by it. A sturdier, reciprocal, three-dimensional bond, unrestricted by short-lived utility or pleasure. If a relationship fails the standard of friendship, we are unobligated to remain embroiled in it. Because despite a relationship's label, such as parent or spouse, at its core, friendship is what it must hope to be.
You're listening to Priya Fulci reading from her book, Good Friends, Bonds That Change Us and the World. You know, I looked at that, and today marriage is the highest form of love. But you're also dealing with how we see things on the movie screen, you know, like this is a sense of like, okay, this is what we're supposed to aspire to, you know, and I wonder in terms of when we look at marriage as an institution for, especially for women, is it one in which you wind up giving up a lot?
Yeah, and I mean, thinking about the way patriarchy, you know, institutionalizes relationships and the danger of that, and I think with this passage too, what I'm trying to get at is that the solution for friendship is not necessarily to kind of systematize it in the ways that we're like our biological and legal relationships, how they're systematized and fastened to us. Like, you might be tempted to say, oh, like, let's to as a solution, friendship is so dismembered, so like torn, like our friends, it's just so inconvenient, so hard to be a good friend systemically, right? Mm-hmm. And the solution might be to make friendship mimic a marriage, right? Like, let's make friends in friendship institutionalized in that same way. But actually, I think there's danger in that, because part of the beauty of friendship, I think, is that it exists kind of in the in-between and fringe spaces, right? It's like unsurveilled, uncoerced. And that passage in particular is, we're in autopilot in so many of our relationships, right? Like with maybe a spouse, like our family members, because there's this like guaranteedness to them. There's this stickiness to them systemically, right? Like they're really tied to us. But friends is a relationship of choice, right? There are systemically few consequences if a friend is to disappear on you. And so at its best, kind of friendship requires a lot of awareness and attentiveness, reciprocity. You know, you're careful about these relationships. And so with these other bonds, such as like your parent, your sibling, what if the solution is not to make friendship mimic those bonds, but to have those bonds see friendship at its core, to aspire to friendship, right? Because to do it the other way around, like simply reinscribing something into the dominant order is not going to subvert the dominant order, right? So that's what I was trying to get at with that.
Yeah, I love listening to you, because what happens is that listening to you, uh-huh, and reading what you wrote, you balance this very cerebral academic with like actual relationships, you know? So what happens is that as a reader, you know, one is able to look at one's life and then see the bigger context. Okay, how is economics, how are these things affecting who I am? And, mm-hmm, and that has a lot to do with sometimes, one would look for your book to be at some sort of, you know, university press for $50, $60, you know, not accessible. You know, or what happened, you know, I would read the first chapter and I say, well, did she ever have any friends? Right. You know, and then by the third or fourth chapter, you got into like, I met somebody. But, you know, okay, what happens, you are able to put pretty much theory and practice together, okay? Mm-hmm. And that's what I feel that why this book is so important, because yeah, if I'm in a friendship and I want to know what's going on and how I'm changing with this person, I'm able to see something much bigger, mm-hmm, okay? And then looking at other models of friendship, and I think that's key. I want to move into something which I think is very important, because especially for our listeners. When June was fighting breast cancer, how did her friendship change? And I know there's a lot of people, you know, here, especially here in D.C. I mean, a number of women who have been widows for many years or not been married, and they rely on maybe some like a sisterhood to say, okay, I have to go to the hospital, I have to do this, okay? And I think that's a real test sometimes of a friendship. You can have a lot of acquaintances, but during a time of a crisis, is your friend there for you? Talk about June and how she was able to navigate her battle against cancer with her friends helping her, support her getting through this serious part of her life.
Yes. And again, I can only say what I found kind of through the archives and research. You knew her, so please correct me or fill in any gaps. But and, you know, I was just speaking to someone the other day who had a similar situation to June, who isn't in that kind of care structure of a nuclear household with like a husband or a spouse to fill in those needs. But she told me, I was never alone at any doctor appointment for like at any night, like during the worst of the treatments. Her friends took care of her for every step of the way, right? And I think for me, again, I keep saying this, but it's so profound to me when someone not biologically or legally fastened to you cares for you as someone who is, because again, there's little obligation and also little few templates, right? Like it's an imagination thing. We don't think, when I was reading about how June's friends, you know, one organizes her friendships into a digital network so she has easy access to them. Someone comes and cares for her garden. Someone helps her give blood. Someone's taking her, Angela Davis is taking her to a doctor's appointment, you know? So when, and friends are coming over and sharing poetry and laughter. And so when I see like this level of care, one that isn't, you know, goes beyond the like ease of friendship. Most of us want easiness in friendship. And then when it stops being easy, we like stop the friendship, right? To me, that's love. That's love. And I, going back to Aristotle, he has also the one thing I liked was he kind of shows three types of love that I think expands the way we think of love. He has Eros, philia, and the third I'll get to, but Eros and philia. Eros is the kind of romantic and sexual love is what he says. Philia's love for our non-romantic relationships. That's how he defines friendship. And agape, the third category, is love for something bigger, like community or God.
That's the Martin Luther King level.
Yeah. And today, like when we think of love, we think of Eros, right? Like we mm-hmm. think of that sexual romantic love. But even just having those three categories really expands our imagination, right? Like love is, my friend said the first time she felt love is when she saw her niece born in a hospital and she walked into the room and just like felt that emotion for the first time in her life. So when we limit love, we also limit how we can experience love, you know? And for me, reading about June's experience through cancer and the ways that her friends stepped in, for me, I was like, oh, like, you know, friendship is the greatest love story ever. Mm.
So. You know, I was also looking at how, and this might tie into you focusing on the individual, mm-hmm. that someone would say that if June was living in the South, she would have this support, like something happened with the migrations, you know, people moving. The mm-hmm. same way, if I'm an immigrant, you look up and somebody say, well, if you were back in the old country, you know, someone would be taking care of the elders, you know, you would not be by yourself, especially during mm-hmm. times of sickness. And it's almost as if here in the U.S., because of the backdrop of individualism you mentioned, that we think about ourselves before we think about others.
Mm. Yeah. And I think it's cultural, but it's also by design, you know, just to think about it simply, the more alone you are, the more politically vulnerable you are. And the mm-hmm. more alone you are, the more politically vulnerable other people are. Right. And it's not, I mean, it's reached kind of new levels with kind of our hyper capitalistic individualistic lifestyle. I talk about this, I quote someone named Amelia Montooth, who describes how, you know, you might have, if you needed sugar, asked your neighbor. If you needed right. to borrow a dress, you might have asked your friend. If you needed a ride to the airport, you might have like called a friend. But today,
it's Lyft.
Yeah. Sugar, you Postmates, you know, dress, you order on Amazon.
Right.
Airport, you Uber or Lyft, right? And that, but relying on friends for these things, you know, we're so timid to do so, which mm-hmm. reflects, I think, the quality of our friendships. But relying on friends, it actually challenges capitalist over consumption and pressures to be self-reliant. And that kind of small favor economy between friends creates great bonding time, you know? Mm. And it's taken kind of new shapes and contours now in our current context, but this has always been the case. You know, Plato, even during like the Roman Republic, like, back then, you know, he said it doesn't make sense for the Persian Empire to foster bonds of friendship between one another. It's no good for it, right? Like, so friendship has always been a threat to power. Because it's linked to solidarities.
Hmm. We're talking about solidarity. I want to talk about the subtitle of your book. You talk about the positive friendship, link it to bonds that change us and the world. And I wonder, how are you able to determine that a friendship between, say, Angela Davis and a June Jordan provides them with the strength and courage to be activists?
Yeah. Well, to me, In our hyper-individualistic world, how can you be expected to care about a stranger? Like, how can you develop the political muscles to care, like, in those profound ways for someone else's well-being if you can't even care for your friends, you know? Mm-hmm. So friendship, it's not an ending place, but it's a place to start, I think. And of course, it's based on how you practice it as well, right? Like, I'm very introverted, so sometimes I'm like, dang, why did I write a book about it? but you know, June also taught me. There's this great story that I found in one of her essays where she's taking a walk in Northern Berkeley with her dog, and this random man runs out of his house up to her and is like, help, there was this anti-Semitic pamphlet that was dropped in my front lawn. My wife is Jewish. We have a baby. Like, have you seen anyone? Have seen anything suspicious? And June immediately stops and gives her phone number, the phone numbers of people who local who might be able to help, right? And kind of stays with this man until things calm down. And that was just such a display of friendliness to a stranger. But then June goes home and this man invites her over and is like, oh, come meet my wife, come meet my child. And she's like, no, I actually I'm tired. I don't have time, right? So you don't have to have Olympian levels of kind of social extroversion to make friendship, have connections to solidarity. But what you water grows, right? Like how you practice your friendships, those political muscles transcend the individual kind of incubated space of that friendship, I think.
You know, when I was growing up, my father instructed myself, my brother, my sister, about not having a lot of friends. He didn't have a lot of friends, but he said, okay, don't confuse acquaintances with friendship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you agree with that?
Yes, I agree. And I remember, everyone at the Humbert was a huge help with this book and interviewing. And I remember very clearly you told me that when I interviewed you earlier. And to me, that clarified how every miscellaneous relationship we call a friend, but I think there needs to be a standard and there needs to be clarity for who a good friend is, right? In order to give it the respect that it deserves. So I think acquaintances might be the people who, aren't taking the steps that good friends are, we see taking care of you during illness, sickness, mm-hmm. and political injustices, seeing how both harm you, right, in similar ways.
Let's bring religion in, where someone would say, this is a religious interpretation that, if you do have one good friend, you are blessed. Mm-hmm. It's like this is something that is extremely, the reason why you have this is because God looked out for you and you have this, there's something that's divine about this relationship. It's also I remember my friend said, when you see your good friend, you light up. This, and you can meet a lot of people. You just don't light up for them. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And that's, I guess, is that have that glow. And sometimes you see this with older couples who've been together for many years. They're sitting and there's a certain degree of not just friendship, but intimacy. Mm-hmm. Talk about intimacy and friendship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think most of us have probably already experienced it before. I write in the book, looking back, if you give yourself permission to see, to love a friend in the same way we do others, who would you be giving long overdue credit to? The people who mothered and fathered you despite not being your mother and father, the people who loved you like a romantic partner despite not being your romantic partner. Many of us have actually already experienced it. And so I think it's an imagination thing. I think you were talking about popular media, we don't authorize ourselves to feel it, to remember it, to experience it. But for me personally, friendships are, I give my friends credit for being my mentors, even if they're the same age as me, for raising me, for loving me, for teaching me what love is, for challenging me, for growing my politics.
Well, before we go to break, I just want to ask you one of these Oprah questions. The question is okay, Priya Felcher, what movie comes to mind when you think of love and friendship? Is there any movie that you have that come?
I mean, do you want me to answer? So
I want you to answer the question before we go
I'll
to break.
I'll answer it. Just the first thing that's coming to mind to me today, which is I was going through a rough time yesterday and I called a friend and I FaceTimed a friend and a friend saw the expression on my face. And before I even said anything, she started tearing up, and I just, so talk about love.
See,
so.
Every time I see your face, I start laughing.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to take a little, that works too. We're going to take a little break. My guest this morning is Priya Felcher. She is the author of Good Friends, Bonds That Change Us and the World. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The show's On the Margin, the station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
Peace! This is your social justice calendar for the week of April 28, 2025. Beginning on Thursday, May 1st, from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m., Dr. Nubia Kai will launch her new book, A River of Prophecy. Constructing a Sacred History of African Americans at Sankofa Video Books and Cafe on 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C. For more info, visit sankofa.com. On Friday, May the 2nd, from 6 to 9 p.m., the Foster and Adoptive Parent Advocacy Center is hosting their third annual gala for foster care at the MLK Library on the rooftop terrace, fifth floor of 901 G Street, Northwest Washington, D.C. For more info, please visit eventbrite.com. Also on Friday, May 2nd, from 3 to 5 p.m., the Young and Gifted Carter Bonus will speak at his panel, Swinging the Spectrum, How Autism Became My Superpower on and off the golf course at Sankofa Video Books and Cafe on 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C. To hear more about his journey, attend this event, and for more info, visit sankofa.com. On Saturday, May 3rd, from 2 to 8 p.m., D.C. Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression presents the Butler Family Cookout at 2639 Burney Place, Southeast Washington, D.C. To contact for questions or more info, reach out to dcaarpr@gmail.com. On Sunday, May 4th, from 7 to 9 p.m., there is a Sudan on Our Mind, Stories from Sudan panel discussion being hosted at Sankofa Video Books and Cafe, 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest, Washington, D.C. For more info, go to sankofa.com. The WPFW Social Justice Calendar connects you with the heartbeat of grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. Submissions are due by Thursday at 5 p.m., at least 1 week in advance of your event. WPFW Social Justice Calendar helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Okay, we're back on the margin with my guest, Priya Volchi. Priya, you have a... make a statement in the book, which I underlined, and I want you to elaborate on, and it's on actually page 39. You write that love is intrinsically a political task.
Mm.
That was very profound.
You know, was it?
Love is intrinsically a political task. It sounds like heavy lifting.
Okay. Okay, I think the best way to get at this is to give another June Jordan anecdote. But I read one of her essays where she's talking about a meeting with Frances Fox Piven, and she talks about how with this friend, like, the friendship is able to stay afloat if kind of the acrobatics of denial are employed. And one day during lunch, though, so by acrobatics of denial, she means like if she avoids certain topics, right? Like if avoid the elephant in the room, which in their friendship is her bisexuality. Okay. And one lunch, though, June can't do it anymore. And there's a huge argument. And June realizes that participating in this kind of silencing, self-silencing, collaborating in the project of self-silencing feels like suicide. It's kind of like keeping her bisexuality quiet is kind of like slicing off your arm and expecting the rest of your body not to bleed out, right? Like, she realizes that Frances has to love her for her entirety in order for it to, for the friendship to work and in order for love to work. And so just in a very simple sense, like, friends must love you for who you are, right? Like, that you can't keep politics out of friendship. Now, this seems simple to me and very clear to me, but then you have people like Aristotle, Aristotle says philia is different from the word heteros. So both are very important relationships to him, but heteros is kind of like comradeship. It's a very political bond. They're very close, but it's the politics are involved. Philia, friendship, he says, there are no politics. Like, politics must stay out of it. And that distinction, like, between heteros and philia in his philosophy never made sense to me, right? Because even just with that June and Francis example, like, you can't love without loving someone, politics included. And there's, you know, the famous feminist statement, like, the personal is political, right?
Well, you know, June came under a lot of attack from, because she was bisexual, she came under attack from people who were lesbian. you know, because she wasn't, you know, she was checking two boxes instead of one box.
Yeah.
And so that became, I want to talk, have you comment on a friendship that you mentioned, which seems like an interesting friendship. And that's the friendship between Toni Morrison and Fran Lebowitz, you know, and I remember that's a funny relationship, but
it's hilarious. Yeah. I love that. And, you know, so the way I wrote that friendship into the chapter on the role of joy in friendships actually was, you know, after interviewing you and Alexis DeVoe and Kathy Engel, all of these people who were June Jordan's friends, and unprompted, all of you started describing June's laughter.
Yeah, because we were all silly. We were like, we never grew up.
Yeah,
we were
all kids. And I never even asked a question about it, and it was like the sound that peppered her conversations, apparently. And it just came up so often. And I was thinking about it. It's probably like making coffee or something. And I was thinking about it. And I was like, because I writing about friendship, and as you say, like love is an intrinsically political task, like writing about friendship in this more serious way, I was starting to feel like an imposter, because I was like, I'm real goofy with my friends. I don't see you know, maybe I can't be like these people, these like historic, like these, you know, iconic figures, these iconic friends who really affected social change. But then I was like, of course, like they were all silly, like they laughed. And,
like you.
And so like, actually, I'm not disqualified from.
Right. No, you're part of the tribe.
Friendship in this way. And so the Toni Morrison and Fran Lebowitz story, you know, they were great friends. Toni Morrison underwent surgery or was in the hospital. And Fran comes from New York to visit. And kind of is waiting around and sees all Toni Morrison was teaching at Princeton, sees that her colleagues at Princeton, other professors, are bringing her these very like serious literature, and then look at Fran in horror as she hands Toni some trashy tabloids, you know. And there's this levity to their friendship. Toni Morrison also went clubbing, you know, and we don't learn about that when we learn about these people in school. And so it's like an entryway to see that like the amount of fun and joy you have in your friendships actually doesn't disqualify you again, but actually prepares you for like larger, more serious political struggles. So Robin DG Kelly, he says like change is not an event. Change is a continued struggle, right? And struggle to me, like philosophically, goes hand in hand with joy. So you can reframe that to kind of think change is continuous struggle, but also friendship, joy, community, right? And so Alexis DeVoe said, joy is, and laughter is the steam that alleviates the pressure of multiple oppressions, right? And so to me, that was just so important to include.
You know, and I was thinking, as you were talking, I was thinking of another friendship that's interesting, and that is the one between Nina Simone and Lorraine Hansberry.
I've read about it, but I don't know much.
Yeah, so it's just interesting that because sometimes you have a view of a person, or you're introduced to a person a certain way, not really like, oh, they know each other, okay. And I think that's also very important. I want to ask of this big question, Priya. How difficult is it to develop good friendships while navigating race, class, and gender lines?
I think it's difficult. But, and, you know, I have this chapter called Bad Friendship.
We'll get to that.
yeah. It's difficult, but I don't want to say it's difficult in a way that like deters people, because again, going back to this concept of like perfect, like good friendship, and like the book is titled Good Friends, you know, like I think it takes a lot of bad friendship to become a good friend. Like
that's something that my mother would say, you know, when you're going off to college.
Yeah. Well, I agree with her, you know, like I think good friendship, I write, is like a practice, not a destination. And right. So it's difficult. And, you know, there's, again, June, the story with Adrienne Rich, where 1982, like Israel invades Lebanon, and Adrienne Rich signs this letter that says anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism, and June kind of, you know, holds her into account. And for me, like, you know, I'm at Harvard, there's so much systematic censorship and silence, and I'm kind of just like, who are your friends, you know, in these circles? Because if you think about, if you don't engage with these things, right, like race, class, gender, all these, you're enabling a lot of cowardice. You're enabling a lot of harm. And the actor Tom Holland, in an interview, said, if you have a problem with me, text me. And if you don't have my number, you don't know me well enough to have a problem with me, right? And I think a lot of people have this mindset. And so actually treating friendships as like the first in the chain of command, so to speak, to be honest and candid with you and respect you enough to do so. June Jordan writes that polite behavior is a civility that greases oppression. And I really think so too.
Let's have you read another excerpt. And this is the chapter 9 that begins with love.
Yes. Okay. At the altar, brides and grooms confess to being best friends. Your other half is a balm to individualism and loneliness, a solution to all your unmet social desires. Marriage replaces many relationships, and the spouse becomes your friend, cohabitator, confidant, muse, and lover. But one person cannot fulfill what an entire community is meant to. One person cannot paradoxically be both your sense of security and also your sense of adventure, as psychotherapist Esther Perel says. One person cannot be your everything friend. We are compelled into rigid romantic structures nonetheless through taxation, healthcare, housing benefits, lack of social stigma, cultural security, and an overall ease moving through the world with a ring on our finger. In part because it leads neatly to nuclear families. And nuclear families are lucrative. They squeeze people into the smallest units possible. Each family buys a house, car, and television. The more family units, the more houses, cars, and televisions get purchased. Goods are duplicated and sold instead of shared, so more profit is generated. The idea that love is exclusive to romantic partners, however, skews our understanding of love. It isolates us and makes us vulnerable to bad loving. Tightening love to romantic edges reduces our sample size. And if love is defined by a few people as opposed to the average of many, love becomes lopsided. We have nothing to compare bad love to, so we normalize poor loving. Romantic partnerships and their subsequent nuclear families are where women are most likely to experience violence, discrimination, and unequal distribution of household labor.
You're listening to Priya Ilolji reading from her book, Good Friends. You know, you read that and someone would say, well, that's depressing. You know, but you know, you talk about this. I mean, this goes against what we were saying in terms of movies and things of that sort. We're sort of socialized into what we think love is.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the whole Harry Met Sally dynamic of like, even, you know, doing this book tour and things, I've been getting a lot of questions like, can men and women be friends, right? And not seeing love as more than that, and also following social scripts, as you say, too, you know, for what love is supposed to look like.
Hmm. Your book also echoes a book that was very popular many years ago, called Open Marriage. I think it was by the O'Neills. I think it might have been the last name. I think they wound up getting divorced, but you know, it was a thing where, you know, it was almost like saying, okay, I'm married to somebody who doesn't like the theater, and so I don't go to the theater anymore, because if I show up by myself, somebody would say, oh, your marriage must be problem, you know, it must be something wrong with your marriage. But you say, okay, but I have a friend I can go to who likes the theater, so I'll just go to the theater with that person. But what happens is, like, yes, everybody can't fulfill, one person can't fulfill all your needs. And it's interesting that you mentioned the community, not another person, but a community is needed if you're going to be healthy, I guess.
Yeah. And, you know, you asked that question about like acquaintances and friends earlier. I do think like we need to qualify who is a good friend, but I don't think that means we don't have space for acquaintances either, right? So the aspect of a community, I feel like, you know, our relationships are kind of like an ecosystem. And good friends have a role in that, which is what I'm trying to argue for. I'm trying to advocate for us to at least have, you know, a good friend. But there are other kinds of relationships that should exist within that social ecosystem as well, which are important and healthy.
I'm thinking of the ecosystem and how we survive climate change. Exactly. Well, you have, and this is very important, Priya, talk about the difference between friends and the relationship between friends and mentors.
Oh, yeah. So I think mentorship at its best is a lot like intergenerational friendship. Something also I've been learning from you and the way that you've kept in touch and have helped. And I, you know, we're so isolated intergenerationally, rarely kind of talking to people outside of our generation and outside of our own age range. But I think it's also very necessary and for the health of a community. And you were the person who I write about this story in the book, who told me about the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. story with Edie Nixon, where he, you know, he's like new in town, a young preacher, and Edie Nixon calls and asks for his help with the local bus boycott movement. And Dr. King says, you know, oh, I'm not sure, like, can I have some time to think about it? And then Edie Nixon says, sure, I'm going to make a few other calls, like, I'll call you back. And Edie Nixon calls him back, and Dr. King is like, okay, fine, I'll do it. And Edie Nixon, who's 30 years older than him, right, says, oh, that's great, because I invited like 30 people to your house, you know, something like that, and they're going to be there at 3 o'clock. So the idea that like he propelled,
right,
Dr. King into the like globally renowned organizer who led one of the greatest boycotts in American history, right? And the idea that older friends can see in you what you don't even see in yourself. And that's very personal to me, like that bridging between generations and trying to introduce more reciprocity into the bonds between older and younger people. I got into racial literacy work because I was a local high school student. I felt like there was no texts I could find. I didn't know where to look, right, with my friend Winona. We attended, Princeton University was nearby. We attended a public lecture and got connected to Eddie Glaud, who is the chair of the department, or was the former chair of the Department of African American Studies. And we were just these local high school students. We didn't know, like, you know, no name, no nothing. And he just plucked Baldwin and Morrison off his bookshelves and gave it to us and said, if you can't find anyone to talk to about these books, like, you can schedule a meeting with me, you know. And he really like gave us funding to print the first copies of the textbooks that we made, the racial literacy books. And so that kind of bond to me, it was very clear that it enabled the work that I'm able to do. And I then transitioned into that chapter. I say that, okay, yes, these bonds across ages are really important. And but also, like, not all of us have this kind of Gandalf figure like Dr. Glaud was for me, you know. I think Aristotle says friends are mirrors, but I think there are more. Like, I think they coach you into becoming a version of yourself, similarly like a mentor, even if they're the same age as you. All of us have experienced this, right? Like, friends are, no matter the age difference, are all mentors in some capacity. And so I think acknowledging that and like giving them, again, the long overdue credit for that role that they have in our life was important to me.
You have a term that I really like. I just circled it. I just love this term. You make a reference to what's called thought partners.
Oh, yeah.
I just love that term, you know, thought partners. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that term was, I think I said it to I quote my friend Johanna in this book, who is my thought partner in this life. And it reminds me of the story between Alexis DeVoe and June Jordan, where Alexis, when I was interviewing her, said that she, at first, when she met June, she had a huge crush on June. And June said no. And, you know, of course, she felt hurt by the rejection. But then June kind of expanded her imagination. She was like, you know, that romantic and sexual stuff, you can do it with someone else. But what, you know, what we have going on is a friendship of the mind, where, you know, in the words of Toni Morrison. And
I like how you said, you can do that with somebody else.
Wow, yeah. And so I thought partners are a way within the category of good friends to conceptualize the intimacy you have with someone, you know.
Yeah, and I felt it was interesting. And it's also, I felt it was key to growth.
Yeah.
You know, like you're discovering things and together, and it's a certain sense of growth that
Yeah.
leads to enriching your life. But it also is tied into, it's almost like taking intimacy to another level, like telepathy, where you know you're this is you know we're one, so you're my thought partner, and I know exactly what you're thinking.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, again, growing up, I'm 25 years old. Like all the movies we see, it's like some dude by a chalkboard having a genius idea strike him, But in reality, right? Like ideas are the best ideas I feel are created when we collaborate and not compete,
I laugh when you say that because aren't you at the Harvard where those movies will take place?
There's a blackboard right
There's a
next to me,
blackboard right there,
right
right
next to
there.
me.
You just have to fill in the equations.
Yeah. And so I think pedagogically, if we can, one of my professors is Imani Perry, and last semester she did something that I thought one of my favorite moments in the entire semester was she on the chalkboard, she wrote all the names of the class was called African American intellectual tradition, and she wrote all the names of the thinkers that we're working with and drew connections between them. Like these people were roommates, this person was this person's mentor, these people were all friends, and like even if they didn't know each other directly, this person was working in the lineage of this person. And as a student, you're like, oh, okay, like this is the tradition, like this is the
No,
practice.
that's basically describing Greenwich Village in Harlem.
Yeah, but we don't learn that, right? Like, we
Right,
don't
right.
learn that. We're taught an entirely different model for how to be and how to think and how to love. And so, yeah.
Yeah. You know, one thing that you talk about, and it's funny because we're coming to the end of our program, you talk about that friendships have n natural endings. And so I saw it like, okay, it's like you go to the store, it has an expiration date. Okay, this friendship is only going to go, it's only going to last until like May of next year. Don't touch it, don't eat it, don't even taste it after that. But talk about that because, you know, many times we want friendships to be forever, you know.
Yeah, it's the whole BFF thing, I think it's just, I say friendship is often just like the study of what it means to be human, and I think it's relevant to friendship as it is to other kinds of relationships that end. They say let go or be dragged, and I think this idea of like BFF charms and best friends forever is just can be disingenuous, and I think it's just offering friendships the complexity we offer to other relationships that they can end. And that doesn't necessarily mean it's a failure of the relationship. One of my friends who I quote in the book was like, would you not get a cat or a dog just because it might pass before you, right? Like there's still value in the relationship, even if it does end. And so, and all I wrote that chapter about friendship breakups because I just wanted to validate that it hurts. Like people don't usually validate that friendship breakups are as devastating,
Well, let's end on the relationship. You are at Harvard University. You're studying in a PhD program doing African studies. What is ahead for you? What you know, you're in this program, you made some decision to be in this program. Where do you feel this program is going to take you? What would you like to be doing in the future?
I want
Mentoring?
to Yeah, I want to keep writing, and I'm here to learn simply, to do the work of the slow, kind of challenging work of study, to make sure I'm writing responsibly and carefully and thoughtfully. And I'm also here as, in kind of the spirit of friendship. I took 2 years after undergrad to write Good Friends, to transition it from an undergraduate academic kind of dense thesis to a book for a general audience. And it was very isolating to write kind of alone in my apartment. And so I'm here for the intellectual community as well.
You know what somebody would ask at the last question. So what happened to Winona? What's she doing?
Winona is a student at Columbia, and we're still friends. And I'm so lucky for my friendship with Winona and also the other good friendships that kind of unfurled after.
Well, I am very happy that you wrote this book, and I'm very happy that I got to meet you because you are a good friend now too. And so I just want to thank you for the work that you've done and the work I know that you continue to do. My guest today has been Priya Balchi. She is the author of Good Friends, Bonds That Change Us and the World. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The show's on the margin. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
has been a site of resistance in defense of truth, justice, and culture for 48 years. Our spring membership drive begins with a special celebration of James Brown's birthday, May 3rd, and closes with a centennial birthday celebration of Malcolm X on May 19th. Two pillars of music and message. Your financial sustenance is needed more than ever to continue this type of programming. As a new listener or current member, this is your opportunity to contribute to the growth of an institution that stands resolute against both gross injustice and repression and the mass erasure of history and culture by amplifying the voices of scholars, artists, and activists whose work centers the humanity of all people. That's 48 years of being a site of resistance in defense of truth, justice, and culture, May 3rd through the 19th. WPFW works daily to build the world we want to inhabit by building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
WPFW commemorates the birthday of James Joseph Brown on May 3rd from 7 a.m. to midnight. Revolution of the Mind, Unpacking the Genius and Torment of James Brown, will feature his music, delve into his complicated and tumultuous family history and sometimes troubling behavior, and celebrate his artistic, entrepreneurial, and activist legacy, including James's live performances in Ghana, Zambia, and Zaire, present-day DRC. That's Revolution of the Mind, Unpacking the Genius and Torment of James Brown, Saturday, May 3rd, 7 a.m. to midnight on WPFW, Building a Better World, one broadcast at a time. Full schedule found on WPFWFM.org.
Code Pink, Women for Peace is coming to you live from Washington, D.C. and New York City, Thursday at 11 a.m. Code Pink Radio is an energizing new program focused on ending wars and militarism and building a peace economy. Listen weekly to robust conversation and inspiration from grassroots peacemakers from places like Korea, Yemen, Venezuela, Palestine, and Iran, as well as peacemakers in our nation's capital who are confronting war hawks in the White House and in Congress and modeling the actions we want our government to take. Again, that's Code Pink Radio, Thursdays at 11 a.m. on Washington, D.C.'s WPFW and New York City's WBAI, an engaging hour of cutting-edge conversation not to be missed.
We are women of the world. We're from the east, south, north, and west.
My Body, My Festival 2025, D.C.'s only abortion access music festival, is coming May 16th and 17th. Presented by the D.C. Abortion Fund and Burger Sounds, My Body, My Festival will take place at the Black Cat and Union Stage, featuring local artists across genres including Alex Vaughn, Carly Harvey, Sicily, Taisha Estrada, B. Steadwell, Zoe Jorgensen, and more. My Body, My Festival is a celebration of our city and ensuring abortion care is available to all who need it. Details at mybodymyfestival.com.
Wondering how to get WPFW swag in your life? Items that say, I support jazz and justice without saying a word. We've got you covered. Details and browsing at WPFWFM.org. Again, that's WPFWFM.org.
Greetings. This is Papa Wabi inviting you to check out my new showgram here on WPFW beginning Thursday, May 22nd from 2 to 5 a.m. Free Your Mind with Papa Wabi is a mashup of positive, uplifting music in many genres, mainly roots reggae. We'll also feature poetry, speeches, artist interviews, and much more. That's Free Your Mind with Papa Wabi,